Session number 22093, Rule 1.
Harold Kirk, Rule 1. Where were you born, please?
In Grimsby, at a pub, believe it or not, which is still going strong now. And every time I go past there during my shopping, I always look at the very window that I was born. Because it's been modernised, but this particular window is still there. Yeah.
Which year was this?
1920.
And did your mother and father both come from Grimsby?
Yes, both come from Grimsby, yeah. Originally, my father's parents came from Ireland. Well, his mother was a Irish Catholic, Southern Ireland. She married my granddad, John. He was a soldier. Because they married, he was a Protestant. So he had to leave Ireland. And they came from Ireland and separated and settled in Grimsby. And they've been there all the time. So my father, he was born in Grimsby. Of the family, there's four boys and two girls. The four boys were brought up as Catholics. The two girls were brought up, in deference to grandfather's wishes, as Protestants. That's it.
Where did you go to school in Grimsby?
Grimsby, I went to school at South Parade School. Well, just to go back, I was born in the Kent Arms in Grimsby, and we moved to Waltham, a village 3.5 miles from here, and we lived there until I was 8 years of age. So I went to a local little Church of England school in Waltham, because it's only a small village. But then we came to Grimsby, and I went to South Parade School in Grimsby. I was there until I was 11 years of age, and then transferred to Victoria Street Boys' School, because we went to live in that area. That's it.
What did you do on leaving school?
Well, it was always my intention to go to sea, but my uncle was a trawler skipper. During the school holidays, he used to take me to sea with him, you know, just as in the North Sea for 10 days. But I'm afraid I always had an idea of going to sea, but after sampling fishing North Sea, I decided to join the Navy.
So, what was it like fishing in the North Sea?
Oh, it was rough. Every 2.5 hours, you know, all the crew had to be up, so all in the nets, you know, that sort of thing. And, of course, I didn't see much of it being only a small boy. But that was it. That was enough for me.
What was so rough about it, though?
Just sea, rough, believe it or not. It was too small. And in a trawler, of course, you live in the forward compartment. And all the trawler's crew, they all live together in the bunks. And it's all close. The atmosphere was close. And the stink fish. No. So I thought when I was 15, I'd join the Navy.
So it was the rough weather, really, that put you
rough weather and the conditions. Yeah, the conditions of the trawlermen.
So why do you think the trawlermen did it, then?
That's all there was, Grimsby. Grimsby was the largest fishing port in the world. That's the only industry there was. Yeah.
Was the money good for them?
Pardon?
Was the money good for them?
No, very poor money. Skippers were all right, but they got a sort of what they call it, poundage of the catch. But the crew, very, very poor. My father was on the same trawler. My uncle was a skipper. My father was the cook. And at school days, I used to go down dock to get my father's money, you know, his pay, every week. About 28 bob a week. That's all it was then. 28 shillings a week. And because I used to bring it home to my mother. And she had my brother and I to keep on that. Yeah.
What was the name of the boat?
Rigoletto. Yeah.
Was it a trawler?
Trawler, yeah. I've got a photograph of it there. Yeah.
Did they put the nets over the side?
Pardon?
Did they put the nets over the side?
Yes, I let over the side and trawled, you know. And that's it. And then about every 2.5 hours, they had to bring the trawl in, you know, and The third hand, it was always the third hand's job. There was the skipper, the mate, then the third hand. It was always his job to release the rope, which, because, you know, the net, and all the fish would just fall out and cover him, you know, because then they'd be busy gutting it and freezing it. And we'll be out at sea about 10 days, 7 to 10 days in the North Sea.
Until the boat was filled? Until the boat was filled?
Well, I don't know really what the idea was or how long they were allowed to stay out there from the point of view of fuel or what have you. Only a small trawler. It was definitely only a North Sea trawler. Yeah.
What kind of fish were they catching?
Cod, haddock, everything. You know, we used to go towards the Dogger Bank and all around that area. Yeah. Now, of course, it's all barred.
Was there any competition with foreign trawlers?
Not at that time, no. We didn't really know much about foreign... Never heard anything about foreign trawlers those days. It wasn't until, what, was it, 50s, 60s, when they had this problem with the Icelandic. Yeah.
Did hull trawlers fish the same ground?
They fished the same ground, oh yeah, yeah. Aye. But there's absolutely hundreds of trawlers used to go out. And it was, you know, for somebody, it was a very paying game. But for the poor fishermen, the lower echelon of the fishermen, they had a rough passage. Yeah.
Was there ever any competition between boats?
Not really, no. They used to talk to each other on the radio. Say if one skipper was going home, and he knew that there was one of his friends on the way out, he'd probably get on the radio telephone, RT as it was, and tell him where's the best place to go fishing. Oh, there was great camaraderie amongst the fishermen. It was marvellous, yeah. They were the finest people that walked this earth. And of course, as soon as the war started, who did the Admiralty turn to? Grimsby trawlers and the Grimsby fishermen.
Was there any rivalry between Grimsby and Hull?
Oh, was when both football teams were in the same league. No, not really. We always said that we were the biggest fishing port in the world. All would come along and say, oh, they were the bit, you know, that sort of thing, yeah. But no sort of physical rivalry when they met, yeah. Especially at football matches, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So what happened when you joined up?
Well, I joined the Navy in October 1936. As a boy, I was 15 years and 10 months old, and I joined the Navy and went to HMS Ganges in near Felixstowe, towards Ipswich way. Yeah.
How did you get on there?
Oh, marvellous. It was a wonderful, absolutely wonderful time there. How anybody could moan about, especially now, I volunteered for the Navy, so I was prepared to accept everything they dished out. And I made a good life for myself. Yeah. And while we're there, you know, after your initial 3 or 4 weeks, new entry training, and then you decide whether you're going to be a seaman, telegraphist, or a signalman. I elected to be a signalman. That's, you know, that's the semaphore, flags, Morse code, and that sort of thing. And I was there for 18 months.
What was so wonderful about it?
Just the life. Camaraderie, great friends. What more do you want? Loads of sport. I played for football, rugby, shooting. I was a rifle shot. Running. You know, everything was absolutely wonderful. How anybody could ever moan about the Navy, I'll never know. No? Of course, and a lot of the experience I got down at HMS Ganges as a boy, I took with me to HMS Bruce in Scotland.
Was that the next place you went to?
I went in 1946 to the Bruce. It was a Fleet Air Arm station, but turned over to a boys' training establishment. Up there, that's it. That was the HMS Bruce badge. Yeah, I went there, and I took a lot of the training that I was taught, and tried to pass it on to the boys, because by then, of course, I was what? 36 then, and by then all the boys who were coming in the Navy were only 15 years of age.
I think you must have been 26, actually.
Sorry, 26. And, of course, the boys were 15 years of age. And so I tried to pass on to them what I was taught. Yeah.
Where did you go to after Ganges?
After Ganges, I was there 18 months at the Ganges. During my period at the Ganges, I had a very unfortunate incident, health-wise. I got acute appendicitis, and I had to be carted from Shotley, that's at Ganges, all the way down to Chatham Hospital, because there was no sufficient people at Ganges to do my, because it was acute and I was in danger, great danger. And yeah, I went down to Chatham Hospital and they cured me and operated on, cured me fine. Leaving Ganges, a lot of us went on HMS Iron Duke. That was a boys' training establishment. A boys' training ship. And we operated off Torquay. We used to do gunnery exercises and scrubbing decks. Everything a boy in the Navy should do. That's what we were taught to do in the Navy itself. And then 3 months on the Iron Duke, and I was drafted to HMS Barham at Portsmouth on May the 24th, 1938. I always remember that's the day because that was the old original Empire Day, May the 24th. And we sailed for the Mediterranean, officially, ostensibly for a 2.5 year commission. Of course, that was 1938. I was at Alexandria in the Barham in 1939, and the Afridi, that one there, that's the destroyer. The Afridi was in Alexandria, and they were short of a signalman. So by then, of course, I'd been sort of upgraded from just an ordinary signalman to a signalman. I was only 18, and I was transferred to the Afridi.
What were conditions like in the Barham?
Fine, no problem. Great camaraderie, absolutely marvellous it was. Yeah, wonderful people. We're in the Mediterranean, you know, we did all the fleet exercises, you know, with all the home fleet and the Mediterranean fleet. Of course, there was absolutely, literally hundreds of ships in the Navy then. And I had a good time. Went over to France and all that sort of thing, you know, on cruises on the Barham, Villefranche, Nice, Monaco.
What kind of duties did you have in the ship?
Just ordinary signalman watch duties, you know. Yeah, that's it. On the bridge. Well, of course, it was a battleship, and it was quite a lot of staff. And we all shared duties. We all had our work to do. Signalman, of course, we just carried on learning, passing examinations, you know, in the department. Yeah.
So you transferred to the Afridi?
I transferred to the Afridi in July 1939. Yeah.
And that was your wish to go to the Afridi, was it?
Oh, no, there was no such thing as a wish. I was just sent for one day by my chief yeoman. He said, pack your bag, you're going to the Afridi. And that was it. Just that. Yeah.
How did you feel about it?
Fine. Go have a quick sip.
Were conditions much different in a destroyer as compared with the battleship?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, but much smaller staff. But the thing was, we were Captain D. So I was fortunate in as much as I didn't go to a sort of what we call a private destroyer, you know, just one of a flotilla, where there's only a small staff. I went to the Afridi with a good staff, you know. I was only a signalman. People like, there was a chief, and then three or four petty officers, a few the leading signalmen, and signalmen. So you weren't, the responsibility going to a Captain D was not as great as what it would have been if I'd gone to a private destroyer, yeah.
Do you remember the individuals you worked with?
Oh, yeah, I remember quite a few of them, yeah.
No, don't bother to refer to any. Just go for a minute.
No, I was going to show you a picture.
We'll look at it afterwards.
Right. Oh, yeah. Oh, because we had our commanding officer on the Afridi was the famous Admiral Vian. He was the man who went on the Cossack and did the Altmark release. Well, he was our Captain D. We're getting ahead of it. But from the Afridi, war was getting really so-so. And we find ourselves up and down the Suez Canal doing contraband control. And I remember going up and down the Suez Canal 14 times up to the... from me going on the July trip to the Afridi to the leaving Alexandria in the October to come home. 14 times up and down the canal doing contraband control, chasing, presumably looking out for the Germans or what have you. Yeah. But again, I was only a young man then. Yeah.
There was much contraband found?
Very little. No, it was out there. All the problems were in Europe. Yeah.
What do you remember happening next?
Well, next we came home. The war started, of course, in September, and we were sent home to the UK, officially, believe it or not, to form part of the Umber escort force, and we came into Grimsby. One day only, and that was it. I managed to get home to see my mother and father, and then we sailed away to Scapa. Yeah, they scrubbed the Umber escort force, yeah, and went up to Scapa, and we're operating convoys around there, operating mainly with the ships like the Hood, looking for the enemy, opening up towards the Arctic. Yeah, yeah. And I remember going out the Hood particularly. We sailed on Boxing Day, 1939, with the Hood. We're looking for all the German capital ships, not the Grasspay, because that had gone. But we'd heard that the Deutschland and ships like that were out in the North Atlantic, and so we were up there. Oh, God, it was terrible. Everything was freezing, And yeah, we did about a 10-day trip with the Hood, and returned to Scapa. We'd been doing it, the Afridi, even though it was only built in 1938, commissioned in 1938, it had done a lot of sea time, and we were due for a refit. So we came down to Hartlepool's from Scapa for doing a refit. Well, I was on what you call Captain D's staff. So, one half of the ship's crew went on leave. I, with the Captain D, went on the Cossack. And we just carried on running, he just transferred his command to the Cossack, which was another Triber-class destroyer. And then once the Afridi's crew came back from leave, the first leave, the Cossack went back down to Hartlepool, and we transferred back to the Afridi. Now, the people who went on the first leave from the Afridi and then went on the Cossack, so we could go on leave, they went away and did the Altmark do. So I missed the Altmark do by 2 weeks, yeah. And believe it or not, the man who went in my place on the boarding party of the Cossack, he shot himself in the foot during the boarding, and he got the DSM.
What is his name?
Distinguished Service Medal, yeah. Because he was forming part of the boarding party, yeah.
Do you remember his name?
Davis. Sigelman Davis, yeah. Yeah, Sigelman Davis, yeah. His father was a regimental sergeant major in the army, but I didn't know of, I didn't know where he was, yeah. But he was a great lad, was Dickie Davis, yeah. Again, I can show you the photograph, yeah, of him, yeah. And, of course, then, Norway. So don't forget, we're now going into March, and everything was buzzing in Scandinavia. So, and in April, we started lifting the troops to Norway. We kept just escorting. At the same time, we went out with the Home Fleet looking for the Germans, make sure that they didn't attack any of our troop convoys going over to Norway to help Norway. And that's where we operated, off round about Norway, Andersnes, Molde. And we went into Namsen Fjord, which is Namsos, landing the troops, escorting the troop ships and also landing troops ourselves. And then we'd land all the troops and retire out into the sea again. And it came to the push. This all started, what, about April? Middle, getting towards the back end of April, when we landed all the troops, and they got a horrible bashing. Because we just weren't prepared. I mean, they went over there just with rifles. They didn't have any winter gear, anything like that. And, you know, so it come to they were getting so mauled by the Germans in Norway that we had to go back in and bring them all out. And that was we went into Namsen Fjord on the 2nd of May 1940, because by then Namsos was absolutely flattened. Again, I'll show you the picture of the town that was flattened. And that was on the 2nd of May, and we went in, tied up alongside the jetty, and as soon as we took all our troops, what was left, it was the rear guard action, actually, and there was our troops that belonged to the Yorkshire and Lancs Regiment. As far as we could, we destroyed all the stores which were left on the jetty by our troops, because we had to get them aboard. It was a question of, do we save the men or the stores? So we saved the men, and destroyed as much of the stores on the jetty as we could.
Did you go ashore yourself?
Then?
Did you?
No, I didn't go. No, I was on the bridge with with Admiral Vian. Yeah. Well, captain he was then. So we left. That was the evening of May the 2nd. About May the 3rd, about 3 o'clock in the morning, we'd done everything. We'd got all what was left of the rear guard. We pulled off and went away into down Namsen Fjord, out into the open sea, to bring all the troops back home. And with us was a French destroyer called the Bison. And about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock on May the 3rd, that was hit by bombs and sunk. And then at 2 o'clock, we picked up as many survivors of those as we could. And at 2 o'clock, we were hit and we sunk. And it so happened that at that time, at the time of the bombs dropping, I was down below in the forward mess deck, because Captain Vian, he knew I'd been up there all with the rest of the signal staff on my watch all during the evacuation and then going out to sea. So about, what would be, 8 o'clock-ish, 9 o'clock, he sent us away to get our heads down, get some sleep. And that's where I was. That's where I was asleep when the bombs hit. Now, I was on the starboard side of the mess deck. You see here, see the port side there? That's the side you're looking at. Under the, there's the two gun turrets there. Well, I was the other side of the mess deck. Luckily for me, I was asleep. But in the middle of the mess deck, sailors, of course, you know, have hammocks. And there's a cage in the middle of the mess deck where we put our hammocks after we've lashed them up, you know, for safety. Well, it so happened that I was, had my head down on the floor, on the deck, behind this hammock netting. The bombs hit me on the port side, you know, just under more or less, shall we say, under the bridge. And that was on the port side. And of course, all the explosion, everything, I was protected by the hammock netting. Of course, I was only 18 years of age. You realise something's amiss, and the instinct tells you, out quick, because underneath the decks where we used to sleep was all the ammunition, cordite, charges, etc. So I grabbed hold of the ladder, because the ladder leading to the next deck, and I was halfway up and the ship went over. So I got shot back down again, and that's how I got severely burned. So anyhow, I got shot down the bottom of the ladder. Of course, everything was ablaze, and I still pulled myself together and wormed my way up on the ladder onto the next deck, and that was it.
You mean your clothing caught alight?
Oh, I was all burnt all over, yeah. The only thing, believe it or not, that wasn't burnt was my eyes. Because instinct, you know, instinct tells you to close your eyes, otherwise you're going to get burned. So I just felt my way up the ladder, yeah. And I always remember there was a big one of our signal staff there, 6'4" man he was. His name was Ross, and everybody called him Tiny Ross. And I always remember, because I was burnt all around my face. I ain't got a clue. My hands and the lot was all gone. I said, because I had my life belt on. We all had our life belts on. And those things that fit round your chest. I said, "Oh, Tiny, blow me life belt on, will you?" And all I can remember, he said, "Okay, cock." He blew it up. But the honest thing was, he must have been otherwise engaged if he got to screw it up. So he wasted his efforts. Yeah. But next thing I know, I can remember, was getting aboard the Griffin destroyer, which came alongside Portside. Yeah. I'd worked my way up after Tiny had blew my life belt up, but I honestly cannot remember to this day how I got on board the Griffin. The only thing I remember about the Griffin now, initially, was I got on board the Griffin and somebody had, and wrapped bandages and that around my face and hands. And the thing I knew, I found myself into a little compartment above the boiler room. And that's how I stayed for the next 24 hours until the Griffin landed me at Sullom Voe in the Shetlands and put me onto a hospital ship.
So you can't remember anything between Ross blowing up your life belt?
No.
And
I just cannot remember until I found myself in this little compartment above the boiler room, where somebody had obviously put bandages and everything around my face and my hands, and that's where I stayed, because it was lovely and warm in there. But I remember when we got to Sullom Voe in the Shetlands. Oh, sorry. So when we got to Sullom Voe in the Shetlands, of course, by then I'd had a good sleep, 24 hours, and I tried to in this little place above the boiler room, where sailors do the washing, that sort of thing, and hanging up there to dry. And there was a blanket. I always remember somebody had washed the blanket, and that was in there. I'd been leant against the blanket, and of course, all the burns that had come through, must have come through the bandages, and stuck with the blanget. Anyhow, with a bit of jockeying, I managed to get it off. And next thing I knew, I was in bed on the French hospital ship Sphinx. And that was it.
What kind of treatment did you get in the Sphinx?
it was awful. They put I don't know what it was, but it was yellow. Oh, and it stunk like a poker devil's, it did. They dressed me, face and everything. And anyhow, as far as I can recall, after two or three days, the Isle of Jersey, a little ferry boat, came alongside the Sphinx, the hospital ship in Sullom Voe, and we went on board, and they brought us down to Aberdeen Hospital. And that's where I stayed for a month, in Aberdeen Hospital.
How did they treat you there?
Very well. They're great, these Scots people were. It took, even though we're in a terrible state, you can imagine a heap of zombies walking around in groups with bandages and an hospital uniform on. But they took us to the pictures, gave us meals, tea, that sort of thing. They were absolutely wonderful.
Is this the Aberdeen civilians?
The locals. Aberdeen locals, Yeah, the hospital we were in was the New Mac Hospital. It was originally a lunatic asylum, yeah.
Were you in much pain from these burns?
Not after the first few days. All this stuff the French hospital people had put on had, sort of cooled it down cooled it down, yeah.
Did you have to have any skin grafts?
No, everything, this, whatever this stuff was, it was absolutely marvellous. It stunk like the devil. When they removed everything to allow me to go back down to Portsmouth Barracks after a month, everything seemed to be pretty well healed up, yeah. But even now, now you see there, see those veins on there.
Oh, this is the back of your hands.
Yeah, that's where I was burned. Now, soon as the winter comes, it all starts getting sore. My fingers, they all split. Yeah.
Your fingernails.
Yeah, all split, and I cannot bear an open fire. You know, and we did have an open, when I was married, we did have an open fire, but I insisted we got central heating. I can't look at an open fire, because I was absolutely petrified of it. Yeah, and also, I'm afraid to go into a closed space, due to the fact of presumably everything dates back to being in this compartment above the on the Griffin. Yeah, yeah.